Hi, this is Roz Bornstein, and the date today is July 17th, 2001, and I am meeting today with Becky Benaroya for the Jewish Women's Archive Weaving Women's Words Project. And Becky and I are meeting to gather her oral history for the Weaving Women's Words Project. And Becky, do I have your permission to interview and tape you today?
Yes, you certainly have.
Thank you very much. Why don't we start with where and when you were born?
Well, I was born in Seattle at the Providence Hospital, January 14th, 1923. I think I was a Sunday morning, a Sunday morning baby. My dad thought that's always important to put down the day and the time.
Is that right?
Uh-huh.
And who were you named after?
My father's mother, which was Rivka, but I was Rebecca.
That's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And where did you grow up?
In Seattle on 310 19th Avenue. It was a block, long block, with lots of neighbors. A few Sephardic and a few Ashkenazim. It was a wonderful block to grow up in.
Is that right?
It was, wonderful neighbors. And we still keep in touch, sort of.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who lived in your household growing up?
It was just my parents, and then I had a brother that was a year older, and two younger sisters. Mm-hmm. And I think I was born in another house, now that I think about it. No, I was born in that house. My brother was born in another house before they bought this house. They were renting before they bought this house. And the other children were also born when we were living there.
And what were their names?
My brother was Sam. My sister Nellie, named after my mother's mother. And Rita was named after a sister that my father had that had died. They name after living relatives and relatives that had passed away.
And what were your parents' names?
Do you want my mother's maiden name?
Or, sure.
Donna, uh-huh. Benun. Donna Adado Benun. My father was Yuda Benun, but they called him Joe when he got here.
Is that right?
Uh-huh. Was Judah, and then they figured it was might as well be Joe. So he was known as Joe Benown. That's how he signed out everything legal.
And do you know where your parents were born?
Yes, my mother was born in, Dikirda, Turkey. And my father was born on the island of Rhodes. And that island has changed hands 3 different times, but it was Turkish when he was born there.
And how did your parents meet and settle in Seattle? Do you know much about?
Yes, my mother's parents came to Seattle, and I think they arrived there only because my grandfather had a sister, and Esther and David Levy. So I think that's why they came to Seattle. It really is a long way to go, and I'm certainly glad that they did come out here. It's such a beautiful city. So I think it was during World War I when my mother has had 3 brothers and they were going to be serving in the war, and the parents did not want them to. So that's their reason for leaving Turkey when they did, long before the Holocaust. And my father had been married before. And it's sort of a personal thing, but anyway, he left right after he found that he wasn't going to stay there where his wife was, so he came to America and decided he would make his fortune in Seattle and then go back and live like a rich man. Then the Depression, and he lost all his money. He had been saving, putting his money in the Bank of Italy, so he didn't have any money. In the meantime, he's married with 4 children, and we always heard that we were going to be moving to the island of Rhodes because it was such a beautiful island. Well, then Second World War and the Holocaust, and everybody in his family was wiped out. So it makes you feel like there's a reason for everything. So we didn't end up going back, which was just fine. But he never went back to see his beautiful island. And how they met, one of my father's neighbors in the island of Rhodes happened to be a neighbor of my mother's. And she thought they should meet. So she introduced them. He came to call. And in those days, instead of passing candy, they served the homemade preserves.
Could you describe that custom briefly?
Yeah, that it was served on a beautiful silver tray, and these beautiful crystal dishes with a variety of different kinds of homemade jams. They were a real treat. And then the beautiful crystal glasses with their silver spoons. You're supposed to take a bite of the sweets, which is very sweet, and then you drink water. Well, my mother was passing this tray, and my mother, being very tiny in this great big silver tray and carrying it, it was a real thing. And she's nervous, besides, because she's meeting this gentleman. And he took, served himself a bite of sweets, and then made a toast. May our lives be sweet. And she almost dropped the tray. That was it. They looked at each other, saw what he liked what he saw, and they were, that was an official engagement.
Oh my gosh.
I know. It's wonderful.
It's a wonderful story. Mm-hmm.
But that's the way it was then.
Mm-hmm. Could you describe a little bit more about your parents, their backgrounds and roles in the family? What
their roles?
Well, what do you remember about them growing up, as a young child?
Well, it seemed like my father was the man that made the rules in the house. And whenever she thought we got in trouble, she was going to tell Dad, and that really got our attention. And he was as gentle and loving, and but she made him sound like he was a real threat. And that kept us in order. Yeah. And my dad worked very hard. When he came to this country, he started, Shining Shoes, and then worked in the public market. And he lived with the Francos, Dorothy Franco's parents.
Marco and Melissa.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's when he was seeing my mother. And in those days, my dad being from the island of Rhodes, my mother from Turkey, they had the class distinction.
Is that right?
And they said that he was marrying beneath him. And he said, she's a fine woman. And we never felt that, the prejudice that so many families experienced. So that's where he lived until he could afford a place. So he had this market. I think he worked for Mr. Hannon. And then he got his own produce, and then he had a tavern, and then he went into real estate. It was in that order. So he worked real hard.
And your mom was in the home at that time?
Oh, definitely. Cooking and baking and catering to all of us, whatever we liked. Everything was custom, a short order cook. My sister liked coffee, I liked milk. The other one wanted cocoa, hot chocolate. She'd bake before we got up, just so we'd eat. her whole job was to take care of the children.
How would you describe your home? Was it a typical Jewish home?
Very. My grandfather was a very religious, practicing Jew. And my mother was brought up like that. So we kept a kosher home. We went to Talmud Torah. My grandfather came over every day, and he'd sit and read his prayer book. So I was brought up like that. And then he had time to play with us. He was a wonderful grandfather.
And what was his name?
Yosef Adato. He was very highly respected in the community. The wonderful man.
Do you have any favorite stories about him or memories that...
He always gave us little stories. Instead of like disciplining us, he'd sit down and tell us little stories with a message behind it. And he was so patient. He was the one that taught me to tie my shoes and how to fly a kite. He'd teach me how to roller skate, help me with my bicycle. He was there. And if you need another person to turn that rope for jump rope, he was there. Yeah, he was a wonderful grandfather. And I knew how special he was. I used to think how lucky I was.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. He would come from morning services, and he always had something in his pocket for me, and I'd wait for him. I'd see him blocks away, and I'd run down to him. I was little. He'd hike me up on his shoulders, and I couldn't wait to get in his pocket. Yeah, he always had something special. It wasn't money. It was just a loving token. Mm-hmm.
And did he have a close relationship with all the children, or do you feel...
He did. He didn't show partiality, but I related more to him. I must have needed him more. Mm-hmm. Because I think my mother used an awful lot of energy on me, and I needed my grandfather's attention. My mother was always, you know, never perfect enough, whatever we did. And then I was the mother to my sisters. She turned all her energies on me, then it was my turn to take care of them. And so my grandfather, when he came, he was my savior. Yeah, he was so wonderful. And he understood when my mother was getting tough on me. He talked to her in Turkish. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, like, back off. So I think I felt more special, more attached to him than the others. But I know he didn't show partiality. I just looked for him.
Mm-hmm. What a wonderful man.
He was. And he died when he was in his early 60s. He fell off one of the stairs at the synagogue. So he cracked a rib, took him to the hospital, and he died of pneumonia. They didn't have antibiotics then. Yeah. They went very fast.
How did his death impact you? How old were you?
I was about 15. And I was starting to go with Jack, who is my husband now. And I always felt that I wished he had met him and I wished he'd known him. I did miss him.
Those kinds of relationships they're very special, aren't mm-hmm. they? And they last over a lifetime.
He was my role model.
What values did he teach you? What have stayed with you? So I was wondering which values your grandfather held and passed down to you that really had a lifelong impact.
Well, I felt it was so important. Thinking about my grandfather, he didn't tell me about not being judgmental, but I could tell after I thought about what I loved about him. It was a live and let live attitude. He never thought that money was important. He always felt that it's a gift while you're on this earth. And the most important thing is a good name, because that's what you leave when you leave this earth. And I thought about that a lot. And I think when you're looking for a mate, you think about those qualities and hope that they have the same feelings about it. They judge you by the company you keep. These were little things that he would tell us when we were little. But they stayed with me. And how sweet he was when we did things for him. He taught me how to make Turkish coffee. He always liked his Turkish coffee after he did his prayers. And so he taught me how to make it. Even if it wasn't good, he'd tell me how delicious it was because I made it. So that's special caring. And you know how parents are busy with their housekeeping and problems. Well, my grandfather just devoted all his time just to one-on-one. And that is special for any child.
That sounds like unconditional love that mm-hmm. he gave.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I always think of him with very fond memories, very close to him.
So was he present then for holidays and...
My mother did the holiday dinner, and
right?
he led the service.
For Shabbat or for...
Not for Shabbat. Okay. He was home with his wife. Passover and all the high holidays, they were over.
That's great. Do you remember celebrating a special Rosh Hashanah Seder for Rosh Hashanah? Did you have that?
You know what I remember? What stays in my mind is Passover.
Okay.
How long it took, the services. But we didn't mind because my grandfather was doing the service. And we'd be falling asleep, you know. And then we'd wake up because we had parts to say. And it was always very orderly. And my grandfather led the service rather than my father. My grandfather. They did him the honor.
Do you remember any special customs that were Sephardic or traditions that, for example, do you remember how the 10 plagues were named? Did you turn away while they were recited? Did you sprinkle grape juice on a plate?
I think my grandfather did that. And then pass the water around where you wash your hands.
Yes.
It seems so long ago I'd forgotten about that.
Did you carry matzah in a cloth on
your coffee? Yes. Uh-huh. Like you're walking with a burden.
Yes.
Then you still hid a part of it so you can go look for it. Yeah.
What about the
It was
Seder
very
plate?
Traditional.
Yes. The Seder plate, did you...
I don't remember.
Okay.
But I'm sure it was all very according to the practice. Well, I still do that.
Is that right?
Yeah, so I must have remembered something from there. Where I think it calls for a shank bone, but my mother had a chicken wing. And I think that was the difference. And we didn't have the radish, which is traditional. We had the parsley.
And how did you prepare the eggs?
And the eggs are different, yeah. They would bake their eggs and dry them out. These were boiled with onion skins, a little oil, a little salt, because eggs were very tasty. And you just cook them on a simmer, very low heat, overnight. That's how they browned them, and they were called baked eggs, but they weren't baked, they were boiled, simmered. And they were, I think, a lot better. I've had the other ones. They're dried, but they're brown. And that's traditional. And our menu is so different, too. The Sephardic menu is so different. We didn't ever have gefilte fish. We had the salmon with an egg, lemon sauce, and parsley. And my daughter-in-law and her sister were saying, "Why are we making this gefilte fish? Nobody likes it. Get your mother-in-law's recipe."
What about harosit? How do you make,
Like my mother's. She did the dates and raisins and grated apple and little Passover wine and ground nuts.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a... I know the Ashkenazic community will make it with apples and honey.
Right, it's different. Mm-hmm. Some even put a little vinegar or they cook it. This is just dried fruits. The dates, and you can put apricots, raisins.
Sounds great.
Yeah, and the apple loosens it up a little bit because it would be very, very sticky. And a little wine, again, to make the right consistency. It's very good.
Sounds wonderful.
I always have to make extra because my son Alan has to have some to take home with him.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Any other special foods that were prepared for Passover?
Yes, the leek patties. Yeah.
Can you describe those?
Sure.
What were they called?
Kuftes de prasa. And my mother always added a little extra onion to the leeks. And I don't know if that was for flavor or to stretch it. And a boiled potato that she diced up. Cooked it with the leeks. And then after it finished cooking, it had to be tender. You drained it got as much liquid out. Then mixed lots of parsley and eggs and matzo meal and formed them into a patty and fry them. They're very good. If you like onion, everybody likes onion, loves these little leek patties. That's a traditional dish. And artichokes, prepared sweet and sour.
Could you describe that?
Yeah, you cut it down to the heart. You take all the outer leaves out and save some of the tender parts. Put that in the sauce. And you cook the artichokes and lots of lemon, a little sugar, and salt. And that's like an appetizer. Serve it cold.
Is that before or during the Seder or after for the meal?
Actually, we didn't serve it during the Seder. There was too many other courses. But that would be another course, like during the week when you're observing the Passover. If you got tired of fish, you do the artichoke. It would be a starter.
Sounds wonderful. How would you eat it?
Cold.
With your fingers, sort of?
Oh no. It's already, you're down to the heart.
Okay.
So you a fork.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about the little leaves. The tender parts that you take off, you put in the sauce. And my mother would put a little matzo meal to thicken the juice so that you could get the juice too while you're eating. But I left the natural juices.
It's delicious. What about appio? Do you remember appio?
Oh, sure. I still make it.
Do you? Can you describe that dish?
You cut it up into... let's see. I try to cut it in half and then in quarters and then slice it again so you get slices about quarter to a half inch thick.
Which vegetables are you cutting up?
Oh, I'm cutting up celery root, which is called appio. And we added carrots to that. And you just cook it till it's tender. They both needed about the same amount of cooking time. You added the carrots to your celery root. A little water, sugar, and lots of lemon and salt to taste. And that, again, is like an appetizer, cold dish.
What would be a typical main entree?
For Passover? They use chicken. I don't think my mother did the brisket, which is, I know now, very traditional. It was always chicken.
Did you eat rice on Passover?
No. No. I remember asking the rabbi about that. He said, did your parents serve rice during Passover? I said, no. He said, then just do the way your family did. But others did serve rice. And it was a very strange explanation. It's if you eat it when it's first made, it's all right, and then you throw out the rest. I've heard that, but I never had it during Passover, and it's still very traditional. I'm not as orthodox, but I'm still traditional. I think all the way, very traditional.
So a lot of these recipes that your mother taught you, were passed down to you?
No, my mother didn't teach me.
Okay, I'm glad you said that. How did you learn to cook?
My father kept saying, you've got to teach her how to cook. How is she going to get married? I think he's afraid he's going to get his daughter back. Because if you didn't know how to cook. So, I really didn't know how to cook. My mother said, she'll learn. I remember trying to cook a few times after taking cooking in grade school. And if you got extra credits if you repeated that particular dish that you learned at school, if you made it at home. Well, my mother didn't want me messing up the kitchen, so she wouldn't let me. So, I knew I could do it, and I knew I wanted to, so I would say that I did. But she didn't really let me. So when I was married, I really did not know how to make even eggs or boil water. So my mother used her energy in teaching me how to clean the house, and I sewed a lot. I loved to sew. So I did a lot of the sewing. Jack's sisters, I would call them and ask them for recipes. What are you making and how do you make it? And Jack would come when we go to my mother's. Becky made the best dinner. My dad would shake his head. I don't believe it. He could not believe it. So he'd start in with the other girls as they're getting older. Becky learned, they'll learn. So she never did. No. So after I was learning how to cook, then I would ask her, how do you make this and how do you make that? But no, she never. And then it wasn't recipes, as you know, because I can't give that recipe either. It's just taste.
Yeah. Can you describe the process or the way that women used to cook of your mother's generation? And
the what?
The way that women of your mom's generation would cook.
How they would cook?
You know, did they have set recipes, or was it in their head usually?
Yes, it was. And my mother said she didn't know how to cook either when she got married, and she practiced how to bake until she learned how to do it, because her mother didn't do too much. I don't know why, but she didn't. So I always found it very amusing when they would get together, the ladies, they would be within walking distance, stop in for coffee. That was the time they had a chance to visit and gossip and have their nice little visit. And if they were going to have string beans for a big family, you know, they'd have to get all the strings off and the ends off. And they'd bring their string beans with them. And as they're talking and having their coffee, they'd be preparing their dinner. That was their outing. And if it was beans that you had to pop open, like fava beans or the barbunya, what do they call those? Shell beans. But they'd bring those over and and get ready for their dinner.
Isn't that terrific?
Uh-huh. So it was very neighborly.
So mm-hmm. They would combine a social visit with...
Then they would talk, how do you prepare it, and exchange ideas as how you cook, and they'd make their dinner. And we didn't really eat that much meat. I don't know if you heard about when we were growing up. It was more meat for flavor rather than meat as a side order. They made the beans. It would be a little meat first that they'd cook up, and then you put the beans in, you get the flavor. And rice. That would be dinner. Salad. And dessert would be fruit, not necessarily anything baked.
How were beans prepared typically?
With tomato sauce, and it would be a big serving of string beans and a very little piece of meat. It was healthy when you think about it. Every once in a while we'd have lamb chops, not too often. French fries were a real treat. So we grew up with rice and pastas, legumes. That was
delicious.
Our main... It is good. I cook like that, too.
What are your favorite recipes that you remember that you cook now?
I don't know if I have a favorite, but let's see. I make cuajado, the spinach casserole. I make that a lot. Eggplant. I love eggplant dishes. I didn't like it as a child. I think that's my favorite vegetable.
How do you prepare it?
I have made moussaka. That's a layered eggplant with the meat and rice in between, tomato sauce. Mm-hmm. I have just fried it, put cheese on it. It's good. I have made eggplant soup.
Really?
Mm-hmm. With kidney beans and pasta. It's a wonderful, wonderful dish. Oh, I have made another wonderful dish where you cut the eggplant in half and then again in thirds, the other half, and make a slit in it. And they're like little boats, and you fill it with tomatoes and mushrooms, and you put the tomato sauce over and bake it. And you do brown it in olive oil. So it's either cold or hot. It's a wonderful dish. I do like eggplant.
And is it served as an entree or a...
It could be an hors d'oeuvre. Wonderful with a drink, or it could be a vegetable with the rest of your meal, or just as a first course. I love those things that you can do anyway, hot or cold. It's a good dish for any kind of serving. I like to bake. I like to make burekas.
Could you describe for people outside of Seattle and the Sephardic community?
Wouldn't know what a bureka is.
They wouldn't know.
It's an oil dough, and you work it pretty much like you would a potato, a pie crust. You don't want to work it too long because you want it to be flaky and crispy. And the filling is like a mashed potato, only you add egg and cheeses. I use the feta cheese and the casseri, grated casseri. So basically it's mashed potatoes. You put your butter and milk and egg and cheese. And you fill the pastry and make little... like little pies, little individual pies. And I freeze them before I bake them.
Yeah. Really?
So that when I want to serve them, they're like, just made them. You could just put them in the oven.
What a great idea.
Instead of baking them and then freezing them. I learned to do that. And let's see, what else do I like to do? I like the spinach bollos, the yeast dough.
Could you describe what that is?
It's a yeast dough. And the filling is, it has to be very dry spinach or else your dough will be soggy. That has cheese and salt in it. And you roll them into like fingers. I don't know how to describe it. You just roll it into long strips and bake them. I'm not going into a recipe, but just kind of an idea of what you could picture.
Of what they are.
Mm-hmm. And that's something you serve like for Saturday morning. That's our Saturday morning breakfast.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have that regularly or is it?
Not regularly, but we did at home when I was growing up. We had that every Saturday.
What would you eat with that?
Hard-boiled eggs and maybe more cheese, feta cheese, sliced tomatoes, olives, and fruit, melons, different melons. Mm-hmm. That's pretty traditional. That's Sephardic. Now, I know that Moroccans don't serve anything with cheese in it. They're not fond of cheese. It's a different... This is what's so interesting about same religion and so many different cultures.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
I remember hearing that lots of stories about the way women would make phyllo dough way back when. And I wonder if you have any memories about that.
I do, because I had to do some of the cleaning up. Never partaking in the pastry making. But they made it from scratch. It was a flour and water dough, I think, and they laid it out, stretched it actually, till it was paper thin. Sometimes there would be little holes in it, but I don't know how they got it like that. And it would take a couple ladies doing it. They couldn't do it alone. So it was always a festive. And when they're making this phyllo dough, it was for a special occasion. So already they're anticipating the fun part of it. So it would be singing and laughing, and it was a fun thing. They'd lay out sheets on the beds so they can lay this phyllo dough on. The great big sheets, I don't know, maybe 3 by 3 or bigger, 3 feet by 3 feet. And they'd, from the kitchen table to the bedroom. Our bedroom happened to be next door, so it wasn't far. And these beds were filled with this phyllo dough, and the windows were open so that the sheets would dry. Then as they dried out, then they'd start making the baklava. That's what they made with the phyllo dough. Big job.
What a huge job.
Mm-hmm.
Did they slice or cut the phyllo in strips as it was drying? Or?
No, they didn't make those little individual phyllos. It was a 9 by 13 pan, so these sheets were laid out. And they'd break off and then make layers of it. They put the nut filling. It was ground almonds and walnuts and sesame seeds, and then like Melba toast, something dry that they grind in with it because the nuts would be too rich. And there's cinnamon and sugar. Mm. Everyone had their own recipe. Then you made layers of that, different, alternating, and you end up with the phyllo on the top. Then they made the syrup. They baked it. Then they made the syrup. And then they cut it into diamond shape, and then the syrup would be poured over it, and they let it sit till it all saturated. Big job.
Huge job. And they would make lots of it, I imagine.
Lots of it, because it was such a big to-do, and they could put it in a canister and save it. And my mother knew my brother loved this baklava, and he'd always find it wherever she hid it. So she decided she's going to play real clever. I'll put it under his bed. I'll never think to look there. Yes, he found it. When she went to get it, all she found was drippings of honey.
Yeah, what a great story.
Uh-huh. So it was a lot of work.
Do you remember any of the songs that women would sing?
No.
They're just happy, joyous songs.
It was Spanish songs. And my Aunt Louise would come over, and she was the one that loved to sing. She had a beautiful voice, and she had this instrument that they called an oud. And she would play it and sing, and the ladies would sing with her. But I don't know any of the songs. We never learned them.
Isn't that remarkable that they would be baking and singing and mm-hmm. playing instruments?
Yeah. Well, when they sat down to have their coffee, now, you know, job well done. Now our reward.
And was this an all-day process?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much.
Was it for weddings or for yes. engagements?
Or a holiday or somebody special coming to visit. It was something very special.
So the women really devoted a lot of their time to baking and cooking. And
And they managed to have their social life, too. And they would bake for each other. You know, come over, you have to taste what I just made. And so they had... It was a very good life, very not stressful, very peaceful. Mm-hmm. They didn't have telephones. I didn't have a phone in the house till I was a teenager. If we needed a phone call, it would be at the corner grocery store. So they kept in touch. It's amazing.
That is amazing. Mm-hmm. And what was your neighborhood? Could you describe some of the landmarks of your neighborhood? Any stores or... churches or synagogues?
The synagogue was three blocks away, the Bicker home.
Is this the Sephardic or the Ashkenazic?
Sephardic. Okay. The Ashkenazim was much further. They were close by too. They were on Yesler, maybe six blocks away. And there's a Beseret. Was on 15th. We lived on 19th, I'd say about six, eight blocks away. Jack and I were married at the Ezra Beseret by Reverend Bihar, who married my parents.
Isn't that something?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Only I found out at the time he married my parents, he wasn't ordained. But they didn't know. It was the only man that knew how to do a ceremony.
Service. Isn't that something?
Mm-hmm.
So, maybe this would be a good time to talk a little bit about how you met Jack and your courtship and marriage, honeymoon, any stories you'd like to share about that would be great.
We met in high school, and he was going with my very closest friend at the time, and we dated in groups. Jack was the only one that had a car. It wasn't his car, it was his brother's, but he could get the car when he needed it, because his brother still lived at home. In those days, everybody lived at home until they were married. They didn't move out. So he had the car, and we double dated, and then one day it was like he wanted to take me out, and it just happened like that. So I felt a little badly about it, and I remember telling my friend, and she had a feeling. She did have a feeling that this was happening, and so he managed to get a date for her, like he did when he always wanted me to go with him. He managed to get a date so I could go with him. Double date. In those days, these young men didn't have jobs and didn't have any money. I guess it was right after the Depression. But Jack always worked, and he would treat the two couples. We didn't do very much. It would just be a movie, maybe, or go out for a Coke, whatever it was. So he got the other one to date, and they got married.
Isn't that something?
And I was going with other young fellows at the time. I was 16. My parents didn't think that was very wise for a young girl to go with a lot of boys because it spoils your reputation. So I had to make a choice. And they said, I'm not influencing you and I'm not telling you what to do, but this is who they thought I should. I couldn't believe it. They were both pushing for Jack because they knew he was very responsible and very caring. And so I couldn't go out with a lot of boys. This is it. You're either go with him or that's it. So Jack wanted me to go steady. In fact, two other guys were asking me at the same time. So I had to make my choice. So that was fine. My parents were pleased. I wasn't so sure about going steady at 16. Then my mother doesn't quit there. She asked him if he was taking her daughter's time or was he serious. He's 18 years old. And he said he was serious. So my mother goes like this. One daughter down. That's the truth. So now I had his bar mitzvah ring because we're pretty young, 18, I'm 16 now. And his family thought it was great, excepting his sister is almost 2 years older. So nobody's getting married till his sister gets married. So I said, thank God she got married. After she got married, I got my engagement ring, my official engagement ring. And that was on his birthday. And then we were to be married on my birthday in January. But war broke out in December. And my mother said, there's no marriage. Halt. We don't know what's going to happen. Let's wait a while. So everything's ready. My gown, the bridesmaids' dresses, everything. And so she couldn't stand to cry babies. So she gave us her blessings. We got married in February. She said, whatever your mazel will be. And that was it.
You mentioned that your dresses were ready. Did you sew your dresses? I
made my wedding gown.
I hear you were a beautiful
sewer. I always sew it. I still do.
Do you have your wedding dress?
Uh-huh, in a cedar chest. Mm-hmm. My sister wore it, too. So it won't fit any of my grandchildren. I have a granddaughter that's 5'10", another one that's a lot shorter. It won't fit. But I have it.
But you have it.
Mm-hmm. I had seen a picture in a magazine, bridal magazine, and I copied it. Do you remember Auntie Rachel? Well, she was a professional seamstress, and my mother called her over to see that I was cutting this fabric properly. And I already had it laid out, ready to go, and she says she knows what she's doing. So they just sat and watched. I wouldn't do it today. Well, I realize now you're just cutting into fabric, yards of fabric, and you could just ruin it. I don't know. I just felt very, very sure about what I was doing. I got a pattern, and I just modified it to see what I had to do with it. It was like a Roman draped skirt on both sides. Mm-hmm. So I got a pattern that had all these panels, and then I just made this one much longer mm-hmm. and, you know, made it according to the width. And I just gathered it up, and it did exactly what it was supposed to do.
Wow, you must have had a great touch.
I don't know. I felt that if I'd had the chance to have any kind of formal education, I should have gone into something with design. Because I've always liked it. Mm-hmm. I think I have a good sense of scale and color and design. And that's probably why I like to sew, because I can do certain things that I probably wouldn't be able to do to find already. And I'm sorry that I didn't, but I never thought about going to school. In the days that I was growing up, a boy got the education, not the girls. My mother didn't encourage it. In fact, she preferred that I didn't. She thought if you get an education, you're too picky when it comes to getting a husband. That was how she perceived it.
So really marriage was very important as a golden life.
Yes, it was, when you have three daughters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you remember any specific Sephardic customs when people were engaged or married? I've heard of some beautiful ones.
Yes. The bride and groom exchange presents, and they have sweets, and they present it like on a tray. It could be for the gentleman, it would be maybe like a robe and slippers, or maybe a piece of jewelry or something. My gift was a beautiful brush and comb set with a mirror. And in the olden days, when they took their baths, they had these little bowls where you splashed water on you, because they didn't have the showers. So I had one of those, they called it a tass, T-A-S, and a robe. Yeah, that was my gift.
Do you remember the Ladino name of this custom, or the...
Mandada.
Mandada.
Mm-hmm. What you send.
That's right. Mm-hmm. What about for trousseau?
My mother was making my trousseau from the day I was born. She was making all these cut work linens, just bed linens, tablecloths. She was sewing all this time. And then she quit when it came to the other girls. No way could she duplicate it. Goes years and years and years of doing this. So I have some of the things yet.
Is that right? Are mm-hmm. they embroideries?
Embroideries.
Huh. Mm-hmm. I bet they're beautiful.
They are. That was the custom. That was part of the dowry. You're supposed to have this. So when my daughter was married, her in-laws were from New York. And so a lot of the New York friends were sending gifts to the bride and groom. When the parents of the bridegroom came over, I thought I would do a, what did they call it? There's a name for it. Anyway, you display everything, all the gifts. In the olden days, they would show what the bride was offering towards the marriage. So it was sort of that kind of feeling. So I thought, she doesn't even know what her friends are sending. I'm sure she'd like to see the gifts, plus the gifts that they receive from our side of the family, and the wedding dress that you display, and the linens that we had for her, and I had it all laid out in the rec room. And I said, this is very Sephardic. I want you to know I'm just carrying on the tradition. I don't know what it meant to her, but it meant a lot to me to
right?
do this.
Mm-hmm. It's terrific.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just thought it was kind of fun, real fun customs. Mm-hmm. And they've gone by the wayside. I don't know of anybody that has done it, my generation. But I thought it was nice, mm-hmm. just carrying on a little tradition.
That's beautiful. I hear that the women would often meet when the trousseau was displayed. Do you remember
yes,
anything about
yes,
that?
Yes, uh-huh. And then the bride had to have go to the baths, the mikveh, uh-huh. and then the coffee afterwards. Yes, they would have this big festivity.
Mm-hmm. So there would be a party after the mikveh
yeah.
as well?
Mm-hmm. Or even there at
I
the
see.
Mikveh. They'd bring the coffee and the sweets.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So did that happen for you? Did you have...
No, I told her I didn't want it. My sister was willing. She was very disappointed. My sister was willing to do it.
Mm-hmm.
She got her period the day that she was supposed to have it. My mother said, look at my muscle. And my sister says, your muscle? What about me? She gave up on the third daughter. She didn't try. But I know my friends have done it. And the bride is naked. They're watching her get submerged in the tub, and then they sing these songs, and I didn't feel like I wanted to do that. Did you hear about those things from your grandmother?
I did.
Mm-hmm.
I did.
Mm-hmm.
Right. They're marvelous stories.
I know.
It's really wonderful.
They're a little archaic, but these are, when you think about it, I'm first generation, so these people that came over, you know, this is how they grew up.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
So they carried the same traditions when they came to the United States.
I think it's wonderful that you've tried to continue some of these traditions
mm-hmm.
in your own family.
I tell my children and grandchildren, so at least you'll know what it's about. You do what you have to do, but, you know, you have to know about
That's great.
Your background.
Let's see. Where did you go to grade school?
It was Washington Elementary. Now it's a junior high.
And do you have any memories of your education there that really stand out? Any activities that seemed formative or that shaped your identity?
I remember my neighbor took me to school to enroll me. My mother was home with... two babies. And I was happy to go with the neighbor because my mother didn't speak very good English.
What language did she speak?
At home?
Uh-huh.
Ladino. And she knew very little English. She was learning as she went along. And my neighbor, funny, she was a Russian Jew. And she didn't speak very good English either, but it was all right. She took me. I was happy to go with her. She offered to take me to school, and I was thrilled to go with her. And we loved going over there. She was so nice to us. There were two neighbors. One was an Italian neighbor, and then there was Mrs. Horowitz, wonderful lady. And we used to go over there. just, we were always welcome, so I remember going there a lot. My sister, Nellie, liked going over to Mrs. Kasha. And Rita would go over to Marcel's mother's, to that house, because she and Marcel grew up together. Yeah, so we had all these neighbors in a row. We all picked the one that were nice to us, I guess. but as far as grade school, it was a very international school. Japanese, Chinese, Black, Jewish. I don't remember anything outstanding other than I hated getting up in front of a class to whatever it was you had to recite. That was painful. That's all I can remember.
What were your interactions with non-Jews at this time in your neighborhood? Were there many?
No, they were all Jewish. High school is when you start mixing. No, it was all Jewish in our neighborhood. Well, I had one neighbor across the street that was a devout Catholic. And we sensed something that wasn't quite comfortable. But outside of the house, we were the best of friends. She was welcome to my house. I didn't feel I was so welcome to her house. They were very Catholic. And there was a lot of this anti-Semitism. There still is today. There still is today, but it's a little more covered up. But I still think it is. I don't think it'll ever go away. So this is what I liked about my grandfather's feelings, that you don't stand in judgment. You don't judge a particular group. It's, you know, on an individual basis. So, yeah, there are people that you can feel comfortable with and others you know your place. But in grade school, I think all my friends were Jewish. Sephardic, as a matter of fact.
And what year did you go to Garfield, to high school?
What year? Must have been, let's see, 36. Yeah. And I think I graduated in 39. That's right.
And what were your interactions with non-Jews at that time and Jewish?
There is where I started to meet the Ashkenazim.
I see.
And there was this AZA group, and there were dances. Mm-hmm. And that's where girls started to date. They'd go to the dances with girlfriends, and you'd find boys there, and that was your coming out party. It was fun.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Were there any Sephardic social groups that you were a member of?
I didn't go to any. I just remember the AZA. And they would meet at the Talmud Torah in that auditorium where they had their dances. And in those days, when there was a special dance, you had a program. And when you get there, you wore it on your wrist. And fellows would come up and put down what dance you were going to dance with. And so you get your whole program all filled. And it was so exciting, you know, because you're popular. You had all this fun. And so you just knew that you were going to dance with different people. It wasn't that way when Donna went to college. You went with one guy and you're with him that one, and you don't get a chance to meet anybody else. I liked it the way it was when we were growing up. Mm-hmm. It was friendly and fun, and then you get to know who you're really attracted to. It's not like that now.
It's very different.
Mm-hmm. I don't think kids date like they did when we did. There was one girl that had open house at her place. Her parents were very nice about it. And we just went down there, and it was open house, and boys and girls. That's
right?
Where we learned how to dance, at her house. She put on the record, and we learned how to dance.
Do you remember the name of this person? Or?
Oh, sure. Lucy Hassan.
Oh,
Lucy Capilouto. No.
And so,
she was a very good friend. I loved her. She's in the South now.
And so her house was open for, Saturday nights?
No, anytime you wanted to go.
Wow.
Anytime you wanted to go. Summer particularly. Yeah, in the summer. You can always go down to Lucy's. We didn't have a telephone to say, can we come? We just went. And they were there anytime you went. Just a gang. And it was always in groups when we were dating. Always in groups. Just kind of like a little clique. We'd go to Elkhai, go bicycle riding, or marshmallow roast, or fish and chips, or that would be it. One person would have a car and you pile in.
That's terrific. And what kind of music did you listen to and dance to back then? Do you remember?
No, it was big band, which was popular then.
And so the dances were swing or what?
No, it wasn't swing. Waltz.
Waltz. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Then we had the Settlement House. It was called the Settlement House. I don't know what it's called today. That's where when Jewish immigrants would come to the country, they would help them with their language there. But they also had programs for young kids.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So which programs did you...
Well, they had acrobats and tap dancing and ballroom. That's the things that I was interested in. I don't know what other ones they had. But they even had a little clinic there. I remember my sister had her tonsils out there. And Clemens Eskenazi was a social worker, and she worked there. I don't even know, they might have even had an apartment for her there. It was a very diversified kind of area where met a lot of needs. And I think for people that couldn't afford certain doctors, like dentists, I think they even had dentistry there once in a while. So they called it the Settlement House, but I don't know what it's called today.
And so it sounds like you would take classes there.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
that's fine.
You could walk there.
So it was close to your home?
Yes. Well, in those days, everything seemed close because we didn't have a car. Might have been about 8 blocks. But if we went in the evening, my brother had to chaperone me. I didn't go alone.
Is that right?
He had to go with me.
How long did that, how many years did that last? Or was there a certain age when you didn't need a chaperone?
Yeah, I was like 14 till about 15, 16. Then mm-hmm. boys were driving, so I didn't need him. Yeah, so he was good that way. He didn't want to go, but my mother said, you have to go. And you did what your mother told you to do.
Back then.
Uh-huh, yeah. I think it was a lot easier raising children then.
Is that what you think? Do you see differences?
I think so. But not necessarily easier for the parent. Not necessarily best for the child. Yeah, because you're not able to express yourself. You're just told what to do.
That was the way it was in your parents' generation.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. And how did it compare and contrast with your generation and that of your children's?
Well, each one thinks they're going to be a better mother. And I know my daughter thinks that she's a better mother than I was. Mm-hmm. But you make different mistakes.
Right.
It just can't be avoided.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So the way I look at it is that you do the best you can. The best that you know how. And I feel that if your heart is in the right place, that, I think a lot of things with my mother, but she didn't do anything out of malice. Just the best that she knew how.
Mm-hmm. When you and Jack married, so it was the start of the war.
Yes.
And what happened?
We had an apartment for a few months. Mm. And then, let's see now. He wasn't called into the service. He was just 20 and a half. And in those days, he had to be 21, except when war broke out, and nobody knows what the new ruling would be. But we were married about 5 or 6 months. Then he was called into the service. So we put everything in storage, and I moved back with my mother. And when they determined that it's okay for us to get married, I knew my mother and her mother, my grandmother, were talking about, let's hope she doesn't have children, Let's see. We don't need that, too. Well, I got pregnant on Jack's birthday, July. I know exactly when I got pregnant. And now I'm home with my mother, and I am not feeling good. And she could tell I wasn't feeling good, but she thought I was very lonely, and so she left me alone. But she never caught on. So after Jack got settled over in Eastern Washington, he sent for me. And I didn't tell my mother till I was 5 months pregnant. But in the meantime, every time we'd come home, she and my grandmother, would say, "So far, so good." And I knew what they were saying. I thought, "Oh, wait till I tell them, or how am I going to tell them?" So I finally thought, everybody in the base knew I was pregnant. I didn't want my mother to hear it from somebody else. So Jack wasn't even there, chicken. I said, "Mom," she was reading the Levara. That was a Sephardic paper that came from New York. That was the only Ladino paper that they had in those days.
So she would subscribe to it?
Yes. And so Saturday morning, she'd be sitting there reading the Levara. And "Mom," she's going like this, she's reading, "Mom, what do you want?" I said, "You're going to be a grandmother." She got so excited. She, where? She's getting so excited. "Oh," she said, "I can't wait to tell Papa." So she yells, "You're going to be a grandpa, you're going to be a grandpa." So they were excited. As much as they wished that I didn't with the war. So I came home when I was close to my delivery date. And I stayed with my parents, and they are the ones that took me to the hospital, my mom and dad.
Was Jack overseas?
He was, no, he was in Eastern Washington. He was still in the States. And so my sister wired him. He came back the next day. And so that was it. So when my mother took care of that baby, it was her baby. She's named after her, too, Donna. So when I left a couple months later, she was crying. I was taking her baby away. "And how are you going to take care of her? You don't even know how," she's yelling at me. She did it.
So while you were recuperating...
I was fine. My mother just wanted her. She's "Let me take her. Let me take her." And at night I could get up and feed her. But during the day, she would bathe her and hold her. And every once in a while she'd let me hold her. Here. When she was busy, here. Like I was the babysitter. It was her baby.
How was that for you? Did you mind?
I didn't mind. I was afraid of her. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how to handle a baby. And my mother, if I were alone, it would be fine.
Yeah.
But my mother didn't think I could, so I was convinced that I couldn't. So she bathed her. And well, when Donna had her first baby, she came over for the baby's first bath, and my mother had to be there. You should have seen that scene. My mother's bossing all of us. My daughter doesn't know what to do. My mother's saying the water's too cold, the baby's going to catch cold. And I had my girlfriend come over with the camera. She was laughing so hard, she was crying. The scene was too much. So, yeah, first babies are like that. So anyway, I took the baby from my mother, and she just couldn't believe that I would know how to take care of her. Then when Jack was shipped out, I came back to my mother's. My mother had Donna while we were in transit. I wasn't sure when he was shipping out, and I was sort of following him in San Diego. And my mother wanted her. She really wanted, I think she bonded to my mother more than she did to me. My mother had a lot of input there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of closeness between Donna and your mother.
And my mother, yes. Mm-hmm. And I think it started from then, the bonding at that period.
Mm-hmm. So you went down to San Diego briefly, or for how long?
Jack had called after he was gone for a while, and he said, "I don't know how long I'll be here, but you have to come down." So I wasn't sure what anything was. So he said, "I may not even be here when you get here. Check with so-and-so. I'll check in with them." So I got down to San Diego, and every 5 days I had to move from one hotel to another. Then he was stationed in San Francisco, and I said, "I have to go get Donna. I just can't do this." So I went and got her, and again, I didn't know if he'd be there. We were living in a hotel. So we finally found a hotel with a little refrigerator. And whenever he could come in, he would. And finally, he called. He said, "They're definitely shipping out." I have to tell you, it was such a relief. I couldn't live like that.
The unknown sounds like it was too much.
At least I can go on with my life now. I just didn't know where I was. I was in limbo. My daughter was in limbo. And we finally could go home. So we stayed with my mother. But before Jack shipped out, he was able to find us a house on 27th, right off Cherry. So we lived there. Then Rita moved in with me.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be alone. And that was about less than a year when the war was over. So we were fortunate.
What a time.
So he came home. Yeah, but I have to tell you, this not knowing is so awful. Even if it's bad news, at least you know where you stand. So I feel a lot of times like when people are waiting to hear a diagnosis on an ailment, that I feel it's better to know rather than dangling. At least you... I learned that from that experience. Mm-hmm. Better to know where you are and you go on with your life as best you can. Mm-hmm. So that I really was better off after he left. Then we were corresponding, and he wasn't where they were really, where it was really dangerous. They're out in the Philippines. So I just missed him. I knew he was okay. And because he was married and had a child, he was able to get out earlier, as soon as the war was over.
So they made those exceptions? Or
yes, it's like priorities. Uh-huh. It was like refrigerators and washing, all electrical appliances were hard to come by. But because he was married and had a baby, he had a priority. We could be first in line. Yeah, they did make allowances. So that's how our first years were. My mother was definitely an important part. We were running home to Mom every time we had a change in plan, back to Mom. And it was fine, because by then my brother was away and there was plenty of room in the house. And she had a lot, she enjoyed Donna so much. So they had a nice, they've always had a nice rapport.
So she was a huge support, it sounds like.
Oh, absolutely. Parents are.
Mm-hmm. At a certain point, you went to Cleveland, is that right? Is this later on?
Well, Jack had invented a truck body for beer distribution. And it was a truck that you could pallet load. You open the sides and you could pallet load. And you could, I forget how long it would take manually versus a few minutes by pallet loading. So he moved to Cleveland because that was centrally located for him to distribute this. He had somebody in Gerstenslagers in Columbus, Ohio, manufacture this truck body. So he would travel all over the country demonstrating and selling his truck for two beer distributors. So that was, I was just told that we're moving. It wasn't where we sat down and discussed it. Yeah, you're moving.
What was that like to hear?
I didn't like it. I thought, don't I have anything to say about it? I'm sure I would have gone along. But to be considered, I didn't have that. Jack and his brother were in the beer business, and his brother was 11 years older. He was like a father image. And from the old school again, women don't have much say about this. So he went ahead, found us a place to live. It was in a hotel, till we found a house. And I was answering ads, and he was on the road already, and I had three children. And that was when I really felt it's sink or swim. I'm either going to sit here and rot, or I'm going to get up and make friends and make my own life. But I didn't have to do that in Seattle. My life was already decided for me. You know, you grow up with these same friends, and your parents are there, your relatives are there, your siblings are there. So here I am, all alone, not even a husband there, because he's traveling. He didn't even know who my friends were. He was on the road, home on weekends, but at the office on weekends. And I found this house. Luckily, it was in a Jewish neighborhood, because I didn't know Cleveland. And this couple that rented their house was called into the service. I think it was the Korean War. And it was a new house that they had built. And my best friend was my neighbor, and I still keep in touch with the children. As a matter of fact, yesterday, Sunday, I called them. I'm still Aunt Becky, and they're my nieces. One lives in New Jersey, one lives in Boca Raton, Florida. Their parents have passed away. But they were the best of friends. They were a little bit older, the neighbors. And they just kind of took care of us. I met her friends, and I joined some organizations while I was there. And she taught me how to shop. She was the best shopper. She'd always take me along with her. She loved my children. So that was my family. So the kids even said, Ellen said, I love you so much, Mrs. Agin. Can I call you Auntie? She said, Ellen, I'm flattered. Of course you can call me Auntie. So he didn't call her Aunt Bess, Aunt Agin. So that was how they addressed her as adults. It was always Aunt Agin and Uncle Max.
How old were your children at the time?
Let's see. It was 3, 5, and 10.
Wow.
Larry had his third birthday there, and we didn't have a soul to invite. We went to the store. We didn't have our car yet. We had ordered a new car from the factory, and it hadn't come. We take a cab to the shopping center, and we bought a record, Happy Birthday, and a cake, and came back and did a little party, just our family, and I started to cry. We're playing Happy Birthday, and we're just our little family. So I remember he was 3 years old. Then we met the kids on the block, the children. When you have children, you meet the neighbors. And I was the one that started to invite them. I had them for dinner, a few neighbors. I did the cooking, which surprised them, because even then, I guess they didn't cook. They wanted to know, they were talking to each other when I was in the kitchen, came into the dining room, what's the occasion? I said, well, you know, if I didn't do this, I'd forget how to cook. So I wanted to have a little party. And I found that they never opened their house. Everything was at the club. Whatever they did was at the club.
Which club?
The Jewish clubs. It was Oakwood, and I forget what the other one was.
In Cleveland.
In Cleveland.
Wow, so a very different lifestyle you encountered
in
Cleveland.
Completely. There was a B'nai B'rith benefit, and the only way you could attend, you had to earn the money. You couldn't pay for the ticket. So I said, my friend wanted me to go. And I said, well, I don't know how to earn the money. She said, well, just sell raffle tickets, or you could do a luncheon and charge. I said, fine, good and well. I said, I don't even know who to sell raffle tickets, and who would I invite to my luncheon? She said, you cook, I'll bring the friends. So she invited all her friends. It was my coming out party. And she said to her to the friends, don't you think her lunch was really good? Maybe we should pay more. And don't you think you want to buy a raffle ticket? She did it for me. So I got to go.
This was your next door neighbor.
Mm-hmm. Wow. In Cleveland. Then this was while we were renting. Then we built a house while we were there. But we still were friends. We were a little further apart. Looked for each other every day. Just a wonderful, wonderful neighbor. So that was my growing up years.
Wow. How did you manage with 3 small kids by yourself?
Oh, they were good. They were good. Yeah.
Did you have help in the house, or did you?
Just not live in, but day help.
You did.
And Jack was hardly home, so, you know, your cooking is different, your shopping is different.
Yes.
So I had a lot of time. During the day, I'd run and play. And at night, when the children were in bed, I would sew, because I love to sew. I'd do things, projects. So I kept busy that way.
And you became involved in different organizations?
Not while I was there.
Okay.
No. I didn't even think about it, other than this B'nai B'rith, because I wanted to go to this gala. No, I didn't even think about it. But I don't know when I was motivated. I think it just happens. People call you. Federation calls you. So
you moved back to Seattle.
Two and a half years.
Okay. And what was it like coming back?
I really didn't want to leave.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
How come?
The children were settled, wonderful schools, and I really liked being independent, not having to account to family. And Jack's brother was really calling the shots. And we didn't have to have that. But then he was the one that said Jack had to come home. So we came home. And it was at that time that Jack decided he didn't want to be in partnerships in the beer business. And that's when he went on his own. Either he could do it himself or he didn't deserve it, he said. So that's what he did. And it was the best thing for him. Got out of under all this, what other people think you should do. You have to be your own person. So I think moving to Cleveland did that.
Sounds like you were a tremendous support to him emotionally, that you went along with him.
Oh, well, I think that's what a marriage is.